Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
In early 1943, Amartya Sen was 9 years old. Amartya's grandfather was a close friend of Rabindranath Tagore, a famous polymath who'd been an important figure in the latter part of the Bengal Renaissance. Tagore had founded a progressive private school in Santiniketan, a town a little north of the city of Calcutta, now known as Kolkata, that rejected the traditional British Raj-style education. The teaching language was Bengali rather than English, and less emphasis was placed on examinations. It was a place for the privileged sons of India's more progressive middle class and wealthy families. But in 1943, Amartya witnessed something at school that changed him. From a 2001 profile in The Guardian, "One day a chap came wandering in, very obviously deranged," Amartya said. "Some of the nastier boys were being unpleasant to him, and some of us felt we had to do something to help. I got chatting to the man, and it became quite clear that he hadn't eaten for about 40 days. But then 1, 10, it seemed like about 100,000 people came walking through the campus on the way to Calcutta to find some charities which might help them. Throngs of starving people had begun making their way to Calcutta from the countryside in the hopes of finding food, work, charity, any aid at all. A famine had struck the province. Amartya recalled asking his grandfather how much rice he could give to the hungry. Amartya's grandfather gave him a cigarette tin and told him he could fill it halfway with rice, and that was how much he could give. And he did. Again and again, sometimes even breaking his grandfather's rule and filling it up more than halfway, doing all that a little boy with a cigarette tin and some grains of rice could do to ease the suffering that seemed to overwhelm the region. Amartya Sen is now in his 90s. What he witnessed in Bengal in 1943 has stayed with him for the rest of his life. He eventually grew up to become a Nobel Prize-winning economist for his contributions to welfare economics, and he is most known for his work researching famines. Perhaps Amartya Sen's most famous and oft-repeated quote comes from his 1999 book, Development as Freedom. Quote, "No famine has ever taken place in the history of the world in a functioning democracy." In the spring of 1943, the thing standing between India and functioning democracy was colonialism. Britain, besieged by war, was still clinging to the last vestiges of a crumbling empire. Indian nationalism had become more popular than ever as Indians, who were British citizens, were compelled to fight in a war none of them had asked for. But fight they did. Indian soldiers accounted for 2.5 million Allied forces. India produced the majority of goods and weapons for the Asian front. And in return for their hard work and bravery as part of the war effort, some 3 million civilians were starved to death as part of a deliberate policy of denial on the part of the British War Cabinet, headed by Prime Minister Winston Churchill. Welcome back to Respect the Dead, the podcast where we don't.
Sweaty, it's no surprise that everybody celebrated your demise, and now worms are eating your eyes. So don't you worry, your rotten head. In your sodden bed, it's time to respect the dead. It's time to respect the dead. It's time to respect the dead.
So it's a Hoops episode. Mine are like, have you ever heard of this faggoty little island?
We're 4 minutes in.
This stupid fucking gorilla. You're like, here's another couple million bodies piled up in Hoots's tally sheet.
We're
like
story
six
of
genocides and a famine, one famine in.
We're so many genocides in. The story of just like this little boy giving away grains of rice in a cigarette tin.
I was like, I told this stupid bitch I just did my makeup.
I can't get through it. Hi, everyone. I'm Mahoots.
I'm Kaylin. I don't know why. I think I was really upset that I was Kaylin at that moment. I'm like, I wish I was some dumb bitch without a podcast.
Oh, and we're back to ruining your day. If like, we hate this podcast. So today we're talking about the Bengal famine and the role Prime Minister Winston Churchill played in killing a bunch of people.
It would have been really fucked up if today we were just like talking about this piece of shit who wouldn't even give like a full rice container.
Yeah, just really coming for Amartya Sen's grandfather.
Yeah. A little pivot for us. Okay, Churchill. But not, so we occasionally don't do somebody's entire life on this on this podcast because they are such shit and they have done so much, either like good or harm or just in general. They've had like a very like storied life that we have to cut out a chunk of it in order to actually do it justice. So today's episode is not Winston Churchill.
It's a just specific this famine.
Slice of his life. Yeah.
Yeah, we're zeroing in on a specific event. This was kind of, this was a discussion that we were talking about during the development of the Henry Kissinger episode, because I was like, in order to make this a manageable episode, and my very next episode was about like fucking Elliot Rodger and we went on for 3 hours, but that was not intentional. I was like, in order to make this like a manageable size, I'm going to have to cut out so much that now I feel like when we do these like heads of state that have like very long and sometimes very spotty records, I would rather just zero in on like one spot.
So this episode is coming from our suggestion cemetery.
This episode is coming from our suggestion cemetery. Winston Churchill is coming from our suggestion cemetery. Winston was suggested by Chris. If you sign up for our suggestion cemetery at the weirdos tier or higher, you can suggest a corpse for our cemetery. So Winston Churchill, in addition to like Chris's suggestion in our cemetery, he's actually kind of been on our list for quite a while now.
Yeah, there's a bunch of dead people where we just like sit alone in our homes being like, I can't wait till it's your day.
Yeah,
probably and like, a little disturbing, but
we've been talking about this for like a year. I think I ordered one of the books that I used for research for this, like before we even started the suggestion cemetery. And then he was like the first name that came in the docket. And
of course.
Like, All right. Well,
other than Kissinger, this has been...
Yeah, he's a big one.
This is the one, yeah.
People have wanted him for a while. Luckily, like, I'm glad that we kind of put it off because there were things that I think I started working on Winston Churchill before Kissinger died. And then I was like, well, fuck, now I got to set Winston Churchill aside.
I'm picturing you like gnawing on like two of these like desiccated corpses. And just like a new one falls in front of you and you're like, okay.
All right. And I'm kind of glad that he did I'm glad Kissinger died
for a lot of reasons.
But I mean, I'm glad that this episode kind of got pushed back because a new podcast came out like last month at the time that we're recording this. Can you hear that?
No.
Oh. So like last month at the time that we're recording this, in February of 2024, a new podcast came out. It's like really short. It's by BBC Four. It's like five episodes that are all about a half hour long. But it's called 3 Million and it's by journalist Kavita Puri, who interviews a number of the last surviving witnesses of the famine and even finds a couple of survivor testimonies. So it's specifically... Mm-hmm. focused on the voices of the 3 million dead.
Yeah.
So I highly recommend going and listening to that. It's really good. I listened to it twice in preparation for this episode.
It also sounds like it's going to ruin my day.
Yeah. So the Bengal famine of 1943 is one of the least known events of the Second World War, at least in Europe and America. Up until very recently, it was seldom discussed in the UK, and I'd guess that most Americans probably still haven't even heard of it. But the Bengal famine of 1943 was an anthropogenic famine that killed somewhere between 1.5 million and 6 million people. But experts place that number right around 3 million. Because famines cause so many other like knock-on events, yeah, like disease and stuff, it's really hard to quantify, like even if you're in eras when there is good record keeping. And I mean, in the 1940s, there was relatively good record keeping, but once all the record keepers start dying too, like then it gets a little spotty.
Plus small children, the presence of bodies.
Infants.
Immediately brings up like all the diseases, all of the... Mm-hmm. All of like the conditions that lead to death, even if you're not fucking starving, if you're living in an area that has, it's so gross to say, but like piles of bodies, mm-hmm, the likelihood of things being like clean, especially in the water in the ground, like,
yeah.
Okay, sorry, go on.
Given that the total number of civilian deaths in the Second World War were around 40 million, we are talking about like one of the most significant losses of civilian life in the entire war, like up to 6 million people out of 40. And it's just never discussed in the West. Again, it's sort of started to be talked about in the UK specifically because people are talking about it just mostly in terms of Winston Churchill's legacy. But that's kind of why I think the other podcast, 3 Million, I really want to recommend that because it's really not focused on so much on the legacies of the people who are involved, but it's mm-hmm on the survivors, yeah, of the famine and the victims. The British Indian province of Bengal was in a region that is now Bangladesh and some of East India, like what is the current Indian state of West Bengal. The French physician and traveler Francois Bernier, upon traveling to Bengal in the 17th century, described it as the finest and most fruitful country in the world, writing, "The rich exuberance of the country, together with the beauty and amiable disposition of the native women, has given rise to a proverb in the common use among the Portuguese, English, and Dutch, that the kingdom of Bengal has 100 gates open for entrance, but not one for departure." But the advent of British sovereignty in the region barely a century later transformed Bengal from a prosperous region famed for its wealthy merchant class and where even peasants had access to cheap and plentiful food to a province where many people were living on the brink of starvation. Now, famines in the modern era, in periods of history where we had the technology to transport and store large quantities of food, almost always have an anthropogenic element. Like there is almost always an environment. There's almost always an environmental element as well. And usually it's like as a catalyst, but this is sort of what Amartya Sen was getting at when he said that famines don't take place in functioning democracies.
Yeah.
Like, you're never going to see a famine in the U.S. following a massive crop failure. And, like, we're what you might even call a dysfunctioning democracy.
Yeah.
Mass starvation is a policy decision. It usually occurs as the result of a number of policy decisions. So there have been a few other notable famines in the region of Bengal during the British colonial period. One was in Bengal in the 18th century when the region was controlled by the British East India Company and millions died due in part to massive inflation and grain hoarding so that this corporation, this company, could feed its fucking army. They were a corporate entity with a fucking army. We will be doing an East India Company episode one day.
there's nothing more like shitty, like post-apocalyptic dystopian sci-fi than like a corporation with an army. Like, what is this? Is just Avatar.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yes, it is.
Which also about colonization.
Yeah. I wonder if he based them on the East India.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, wait a second. Was this bitch British?
But another famine occurred exactly 70 years before the 1943 famine, the Bihar famine of 1873 to 1874. And I just want to talk about that briefly. In 1873, the newly appointed Lieutenant Governor of Bengal was a man named Sir Richard Temple. There had been a drought in Bihar, Bengal, and the northwestern provinces, affecting an area of around 140,000 square kilometers and a population of almost 22 million people. Lieutenant Governor Temple was warned that there was an impending famine and made the decision to save lives at any cost. 450,000 tons of rice were imported from Burma, and government officials went village to village conducting inspections for anyone in need of employment or aid. Even Queen Victoria donated £1,000, which is equivalent to almost 160,000 pounds today, to famine relief. The result was virtually no loss of life. Lieutenant Governor Temple also pointed to the fact that since the starvation was so much less severe than anticipated due to famine relief, that when the famine ended, laborers were able to return to work, which also meant the effect on the local economy was less severe. So, like, this was his way of justifying giving out government handouts to British officials.
Already, I could hear Justin Trudeau being like, listen, all that money we gave out during the pandemic, they're putting it right back into the economy. It's fine.
Yeah.
That's why it's good that we're not all dead. Like, I could think of like a couple more reasons why not letting 22
million people die.
Oh, 22 million. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Close.
Yeah. So, like, nobody. Almost nobody died.
Yeah, I'm sure people were dying. People do that every day. But like,
yeah, it's hard to say like exactly zero people died. But to our knowledge, like nobody died. People were not like, again, like people were not having an amazing time because there were food shortages. But they were like, they weren't living it up and feasting. But they were like, okay, I can get through this. And they did. But despite this indisputable success, British officials back home sharply criticized Sir Temple for what they considered to be useless expenditures. Temple eventually became the official famine commissioner for the government of India, in part due to his success in Bihar, but he revised his official famine relief policy in response to the criticism from back home. So the next famine that occurred under his watch, the Great Famine of 1876 to 1878, claimed somewhere between 5.6 and 9.6 million lives. So when I say that famine is a policy failure, this is what I mean.
Like I can actually point to the policies.
Yeah. 70 years before the events we're focusing on in this episode, the British government knew that if they spent money on relief, they could ride out a famine with little or no deaths. Alternatively, they could pinch a few pennies and sacrifice millions of British citizens. So we're going to talk about Bengal, but just before we do that, let's take a little ad break. The province of Bengal was largely agrarian, and rice accounted for 88% of its arable land use and 75% of its crops. Rice also accounted for between 75 to 80% of Bengal's daily food consumption, with fish being the second major food source. However, the agricultural output in the region was relatively low due to a number of factors like soil quality and agricultural technology. By the early 20th century, the population of Bengal had grown significantly, in no small part due to declining mortality rates. People were living longer. And, like, this is one of the things that people point to and being like, hey, see, the British Raj was good, actually, because people lived longer. But, like, people all over the world were living longer in the 20th century. That was, like, post-industrialization.
Okay. And depending where you are too, it's also suffer longer, so I don't necessarily know that we could just like point to that as like a great metric. Like, people in prison are living longer and longer every year.
Yeah, there were declining mortality rates all over the world in the early 20th century. So basically, this area of the world is also seeing declining mortality rates. And because of that, their population is growing. They have a much larger elderly population than they used to have. So this puts a strain on the agricultural sector to keep people fed, which meant agricultural expansion, which meant deforestation, which meant drainage issues, like all tales as old as agriculture.
Yeah.
By the 1920s and the Great Depression, there is just like no more room to expand. And the region is barely producing enough food for subsistence. And people start to recognize that this could be a real problem in the future. Mm-hmm. So like almost 20 years before the famine actually happens, people are like, hey, looks like we have the pieces in place for a famine. It looks like we have the environmental like requirements, like calling it out.
Too many people, not enough food and not enough places to expand to grow more food.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This could be a problem for us in the future. We need to do something about it. The British Raj had a very intricate social hierarchy of landowners and peasants that I do not want to get into. But by the 19th and 20th centuries, the upper middle class experienced an economic boom essentially through lending, and the smaller landowning peasants and laborers were consistently getting into these cycles of debt as they'd have to take out loans or lease equipment and cows to make it through the leaner seasons.
Leasing a cow?
Yeah, like renting a cow like you would rent like a tractor or something. Yeah, it would be so cute if it wasn't leading to like growing wealth inequality in the region.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't like the money aspect of the lease. I just like
borrowing. Like borrowing a cow.
You could have a lease without money. It's just saying that you only have it for a little period of time.
Yeah. Hey, bro, can I borrow your cow? Sure,
my
buddy.
My lawn is wild right now.
So, like I said, there's growing wealth inequality in the region. And by the Great Depression, the laborers working the land in Bengal are basically living on a single portion of rice a day. And then on September 3rd, 1939, Great Britain declares war on Germany. Now, the guy who officially announces that Britain is at war was the prime minister at the time, a man named Neville Chamberlain, but he's soon to be succeeded by the man occupying the position of the First Lord of the Admiralty, basically just the head of the Navy, a man named Winston Leonard Spencer Churchill.
Ew, Leonard. Winston Leonard Spencer Churchill.
Every name just gets toffier than the last.
I know that the richer you get, the more names you need. But I don't know. I know this is confirmation bias, but there's like a lot of like serial killers with three or four names. So just saying, maybe don't give your children that many names. In fact, let's stop doing middle names.
Yeah, let's cancel middle names. Like,
they're more likely to be famous than killers.
Let's forego last names as well. Let's just do a name, like Cher.
Oh, that's cute. Yeah. We all have like, oh no. I was like, we'd all need like some sort of like an identifier. So like maybe we could get a little tech. Nope.
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 Bad idea. You know what? Let's also normalize having bad ideas and scrapping them.
Yeah.
Winston Churchill was the prime minister throughout most of the Second World War and the head of the war cabinet. And he's remembered mostly with fondness in Britain and America and pretty much everywhere outside of India, where he is not remembered so well.
This is the same with Mother Teresa.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's like everyone in the world is like, she's so great. And in India, they're like, yeah, fuck that hag.
You know what? Normalize listening to more Indians as well. Yeah,
how about
they seem
that?
To have some good opinions about a lot of people.
Yeah.
And this is not just because he was the prime minister who, like people's fondness for him was not just because he was the prime minister who led the country through a difficult war that he'd ultimately win. I mean, that's definitely part of it. But also because, like, credit where credit is due, he generated absolute banger quotes at like a fucking supernatural rate. He was like a fucking Aaron Sorkin.
So did Rob Ford, but like,
yeah,
it doesn't mean you have to respect him.
Oh, they weren't ironically bad.
Okay,
like a lot of them were good. He has some good speeches and stuff. I don't want to look any of them up though, because some of them are apocryphal. So like liberals love him because he is just like a racist Aaron Sorkin character. And we're gonna zero in on some of the racism today, because Winston Churchill's opinions about Indians may have had a little something to do with his policies in Bengal.
Yeah, one could posit.
His responses to the famine were certainly a little blasé when he was made aware of the famine happening under his watch. He blamed the famine on Indians breeding like rabbits, or insisted that starvation of anyhow underfed Bengalis is less serious than that of sturdy Greeks. Like, it's okay. They're naturally skinny. We got to go feed our Greek bears.
Hey, number one, he was so hard for Greeks.
Yeah, like, sturdy Greeks.
He loves a sturdy Greek. I am so Greek for like a sturdy man.
I'm so Greek, like, for a man with like a thick hairy chest.
Yeah. So fucked up to be like, sure, they're starving, but like, aren't they always kind of starving?
Yeah, like they're used to it by now. It's fine. Like polar bears in the cold.
Like, aren't they cold? Like, no, don't worry about it.
Like, no, honey, I don't think that's how that works.
No.
They're not a different species. They also need calories to live.
Especially, like you were saying, like workers subsisting off of like a single portion a day, like that kind of, like, no calories in, so many calories out.
Right.
Is
so they were living like that before the famine. And then it's like, now you don't get your single portion of rice.
The difference between alive and dead, when all you normally get to eat is a single portion of rice, is like a single portion of rice. Something that people in other countries are just throwing in the garbage because somebody didn't eat it. Like, I know that's not like the norm at the time, at least not for like laborers in other countries, but like still they, like, people had that to spare, which also puts another bit of like weight on the story you told in the intro.
Oh yeah. I believe that Amartya Sen saved some people.
Yeah.
So I'm sure a lot of those people still succumbed to the famine eventually, but he got them through a day. And I have to believe that that little boy was the reason some people made it through the famine, you know?
Yeah.
We'll never know, because he never knew them. They were strangers to him. I don't think he ever even got their names. So we are inevitably going to get comments from people saying that Churchill was a man of his time, and I need to shut that shit down like right away, because Churchill was considered spectacularly racist even for his time and even among his Conservative Party peers. His hatred for Indians and Hindus in particular, who he described as a beastly people with a beastly religion, was so vile that in the aftermath of the war, some of his fellow Conservative Party members suggested that they didn't take his early warnings about Hitler seriously because they saw his virulent racism toward Indian people and Hitler's toward the Jews as one and the same. Like, because he was banging the drum about Hitler from like pretty early on in the late 20s, early 30s. And people were like, yeah, but like, he just sounds like you, dude, and we're friends with you. You're fine.
Like, yeah, we're all friends with people who have opinions we don't agree with.
Yeah.
So what? Adolf and I have a really good time over, I don't know what they call beer over there. Beer?
I think beer they do. And- What's German stands go off. What's German for beer? Is it beer?
It's got to be beer, right?
It's got to be beer. That sounds like a German word.
Yeah.
Beer.
It's probably B-E-I-R or something, but it's probably still beer. Yeah.
I love that they're like, yeah, you were like a boy who cried wolfing about race realism.
The idea that people wouldn't become alarmed at what was happening because they recognized that it was just as bad.
Mm-hmm.
With someone that's their head of state, but then still not be like, and we should do something about that. They're just like, well, it's bad, but like, can't be that bad because it's happening here. And I'm like,
Yeah. But they recognized that it was bad. Like, they were also men of their time and they were also conservative. Yeah. So, like, probably like more racist men of their time. And they were like, I mean, Winston's our most racist friend.
It's like, so who's coming out tonight? I want to know your friends before we meet them. Like, let me know who we're meeting at the bar. It's like, well, there's like, I don't know what old people's names are. Thomas, he's, well, drunk all the time. There's Frederick, also drunk. Billiam, opiates. And okay, so we're just don't talk to Winston. Don't talk to Winston at all. And if he starts talking about Indians, just change the subject because he will go on for the entire night.
As a soldier in the British Army, Churchill had been stationed in India for a time in the 1890s. But his antipathy toward Indians didn't really calcify until following the First World War, when the Government of India Act of 1919 was passed, allowing for more Indians to participate in elections. He vehemently opposed the Government of India Act of 1935, which further expanded Indians' rights to self-governance and self-determination. So, like, there were these series of acts that not only, like, allowed more freedom in elections, but also, like, more self-governance, allowing, like, actual Indians to run for local offices, all of which could at any point be overruled by the colonial government. Yeah. But there were expansions to political self-determination in the area, and he fucking hated that. And his racism, like his like really outspoken racism about Indians, started to stem from like these movements, for more autonomy and independence. Mm-hmm. And Churchill's attitudes towards Indians and the idea of Indian independence were also allegedly the source of strain between himself and his wartime ally, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So this was the president during the U.S.
Wait, did I say Franklin as one of the friends?
No.
Okay, damn it. I was like, oh my God. I'm like, reverse prescient.
Like six months ago when we were talking about doing a Winston episode, you were like, I don't ever learn anything about Americans.
Yeah, I still kind of think he's the president of the United States. And also, I messaged several of my stupid gay friends. Sorry to you if you're my stupid gay friend. But I was like, do you know who Winston Churchill is? And I got at least three replies who were like, the president?
Two almost. Who were so close. Well, that is a shape.
So close. That's a shape.
He was the prime minister, which is kind of like the president, but of British people.
So the
president was FDR.
America, but with tea.
Yes. Mm-hmm. America, coffee. Britain is when tea. So FDR was like, you have to stop with the racist jokes around me. It just makes me really uncomfortable. Indian nationalism was experiencing a groundswell in the period between the two world wars, because again, Indians were a big part of the British army in the First World War as well. And they're like, mm-hmm. hey, since we're like fighting your wars for you, can you like,
yeah.
It's like the argument of like, you know, in the U.S., like you're when you're 18, you're old enough to go join the army, but not to drink. It's like, yeah. Well, you're telling me that I'm like mature enough as a country and a people to fight your wars for you, but not yeah. to like participate in elections and things like.
Yeah, we can kill. I think and we need to change for that. You.
Yeah.
But our voices don't matter. Like,
yeah. Mm. and the groundswell of Indian nationalism was also in part due to the leadership of friend of the pod, Mahatma Gandhi.
Oh.
Who Winston Churchill really did not like. But not for the reasons we don't like him. Like he said a lot of racist stuff about Gandhi, obviously, but he also kept trying to accuse Gandhi of being like a Japanese op and what? Saying that like he was like saying like, where are your Japan checks coming from? Oh, you got another like.
This is just, let me see your birth certificate.
Yeah. anyway, and he kept saying that Gandhi's hunger strikes were fake and that he was like drinking glucose in the water. Like he was like, I know he's faking it.
I love that. Okay, that would be fucking based. A fake hunger strike is fucking hilarious.
You could do it now in Photoshop.
I do love the idea of being like, he's faking his hunger strike. There's sugar in that water. And I'm like, that's not eating. That's still actually not eating, babe.
getting like 100 calories a day, getting 400 calories a day is still a hunger strike.
I still think this bitch is hungry.
Yeah. And when Churchill was first alerted to the famine breaking out in Bengal, he responded with a telegram asking why Gandhi hadn't died yet.
Oh, he's petty.
People love him because he's petty and cruel, but it's like money also racist.
It's like the Trump effect.
Yeah. Oh my God, he's so Trump.
Of like, sure, he says this horrible, terrible, fucking crass shit. And that's why we love him.
Yeah. Okay, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, so let's take another ad break. Speaking of Trump, let's get some ads for like Trump coins or whatever. Do you remember his coins? At the end of 1941, the United States and Japan entered the war. Allied soldiers from Britain, the U.S., and China flooded into the capital of Bengal, Calcutta, some on leave, some on their way to the Pacific Theater. This puts further strain on local resources for the poor civilians. The army had a great fucking time. Servicemen were put up at the Grand Hotel, and there were so many swanky cocktail parties for the soldiers at Calcutta's jazz clubs that the city experienced an ice shortage.
I'm going to flip this desk. I'm going to flip this motherfucking desk. Not an ice shortage. Commander, the entire country's out of these tiny decorative umbrellas.
Okay, the soldiers really had to bear their own fucking famine. No, listen, ice
we
for
all
their
had crosses
fashions.
To bear. My drink was room temperature. The temperature of a room. Would you drink that?
Have you ever had a room temperature gin and tonic before? I still have nightmares.
I still wake up screaming and yell at my wife.
One of the witnesses of the Bengal famine that BBC's 3 Million interviewed, a man called Partha Meter, who was a child at the time, remarked about how American officers were actually quite horrified by the whole institution of the British Raj. Interesting enough, like this was before the US became the empire that it is today. And the American soldiers just couldn't understand how Britain could be fighting a war against a brutal expansionist empire while being one. Isn't that interesting?
It's a little quaint, ain't it?
How times change. And they were absolutely right. And that was like one of the main arguments that Indian nationalists were using. In a 1987 interview, Major General Dartiri Kumar Palit noted that English soldiers stationed in Calcutta were more likely to assimilate and learn Hindi and Urdu, but officers would not and were far more explicitly racist than their inferiors. So there was like, it seems like there was like maybe a class element and also maybe kind of like a generational thing as well. Like younger foreigners were more sympathetic to Indian nationalism than some of the older Brits. In addition to the strain on food, the military presence in Calcutta causes massive inflation on goods like textiles because firms were required to sell to the military at fixed prices, but free to charge whatever they wanted to everyone else. So they'd try to offset the losses on the sale of things like cloth to the military by charging Indian civilians outrageous prices. So there's also like a cloth famine happening at the exact same time. Like people are dying of starvation and naked in the streets.
Literally everything about this, like as you said from the very beginning, is like not just like a policy failure, but a completely unnecessary policy failure. Like the military didn't need a little discount. Like these prices didn't need to be offset. It's very rules for thee, but not for me. These bitches getting their fucking hand out.
In 1942, Japan invaded neighboring Burma. So this means that not only is there an influx of Burmese refugees into Bengal, but now Bengal can't rely on Burmese imports of rice. Now, remember, during the Bihar famine, Sir Richard Temple imported rice and grain from Burma as aid. Britain responds to this invasion of Burma. By enacting a denial policy in Bengal, seizing and in many cases outright destroying supplies of rice and vehicles so that if Japan invaded, they couldn't access transport or food. The destruction of boats in particular was huge. Like in some cases, colonial authorities went door to door taking civilian boats. And boats were one of the main methods of transportation in Bengal, which meant that people couldn't get from villages to towns, fishermen couldn't get to sea, and farmers couldn't access some of their upstream plots. Like not having a boat is like a huge deal when you're farming rice, which is grown in like wet paddies. And remember, other than rice, fish is the other major food source in the area. So now there's an
also
artificial
commonly found in water.
In water, yeah. Kind of need boats to access most of them.
Fuck
so,
off.
Yeah. So now there are two artificial shortages, like of the two main sources of nutrition people tend to
and
have
cloth.
Access to in that area. And cloth. Just to add insult to injury. Some of the rice seized by British authorities was sent to Calcutta, where the influx of Allied soldiers was already putting a strain on resources. But British and American soldiers obviously had priority status in accessing those food supplies. Additionally, workers in war-related industries and members of the middle and upper classes were placed in priority class when it came to the access of goods and food, and in many cases, their food was subsidized by the government. But this meant that the rural poor were basically just left to fend for themselves. The people who were already the most at risk of food insecurity were the ones facing purchasing rice at hyperinflated prices. In October of 1942, a cyclone passed through the Bay of Bengal, killing 14.
Oh, come
14-
on.
Yeah. Like, this one's on God.
Come on. You got to be freaking kidding me. Fuck off.
Yeah.
Let's fucking, like, out of cyclone. I swear to God. I'm going to, like, don't make me go back there. I don't know what I'm going to do against a cyclone.
But like, beat that cyclone's ass.
I'm going to whoop it. Like, what the fuck? Sorry, I know this is like...
No.
It's like a bunch of people are going to die, and it's not funny. But I'm like, Jesus.
Good God.
This is too much.
So the cyclone killed about 14,000 people and 190,000 cattle.
Okay, these days there'll be a cyclone and it'll like barely kill 14 people.
And like it will be like on the news people, for weeks.
Yeah.
14,000 people.
Is it because people were living in such close proximity?
Yeah, and in the rural areas, I don't think that there was a lot of infrastructure. Like nowadays, in places that get hit by a lot of hurricanes, we have hurricane-proofing for our houses.
Right.
I don't even know if wealthy people had much hurricane-proofing back then. Now, the shortfall in the crop due to brown spot disease has been blamed for playing a role in the famine, but according to Amartya Sen, quote, "The rice paddy supply for 1943 was only about 5% lower than the average of the preceding 5 years. It was, in fact, 13% higher than in 1941. And there was, of course, no famine in 1941. So he's positing that, like, even though there was damage to the crop, like, there were already the conditions for a famine, an anthropogenic famine. So it's just, like... The cyclone did not cause the famine.
Yeah.
You know. In the immediate aftermath of the fall of Burma, there was so much anxiety over the rising cost of rice that provincial trade barriers were initially imposed in India in order to try to restrict the flow of rice in and out of other provinces and prevent other emergencies. When these were eventually lifted, it just caused the price of rice to skyrocket. As like even more people started hoarding and speculating, and the market went into like a fucking like spiral. Like, so a lot of this is caused by hoarding. So by December of 1942, it's pretty clear that there's going to be a famine. The Viceroy of India, Victor Linlithgow, wrote to London warning of impending rice shortages and requesting food aid. The request was denied. Britain needed her ships for the war effort and to maintain Britain's food reserves. Said Churchill, "Indians must learn to look after themselves as we have done. The grave situation of the UK import program imperils the whole war effort, and we cannot afford to send ships merely as a gesture of goodwill." These are British citizens.
I was about to say,
like,
that's not good fucking will.
Yeah. Those are your people.
A gesture of goodwill.
He doesn't see them as human beings.
I don't think saving someone's life is a gesture. I think it's your responsibility when you're the state.
Like, saving someone's life that Jesus you are responsible Christ. To save. Yeah. Like, you don't get to have it both ways. You don't get to be like, they are British citizens when I need them to do my will.
Yeah.
To bend to my will and do my bidding. But then they're not British citizens when they need something from me. Like, you want to have an empire, then have a fucking empire.
Yeah.
Like, that means you have more responsibility.
Yeah. Me doing a gesture of goodwill when I take my baby out of the crib when the house is on fire. I'm like, you know what? Like, I guess I'm just a really nice person who doesn't mind like putting myself out there for strangers.
Over the next several months, Lynn Lithgow, as well as India's Secretary of State Leo Amery, Commander-in-Chief of the British Forces in India, General Claude Auchinleck, and Supreme Commander of Southeast Asia and uncle of future Prince Philip, Admiral Louis Mountbatten, sent progressively more desperate requests for food aid to the British War Cabinet, but they're repeatedly denied, either denied or given woefully inadequate supplies of wheat. So it's not just Linlithgow at this point. It's like every British colonial officer, like everybody with a position of power in India at this moment is like, hey, we need food. Things are getting really bad here.
Yeah, and what the fuck's Winston's going
on? I don't know. I don't know what to do.
What do you want me to do? It's like send food. It's like, well, here's a little bag of rice. Here's a little bag of wheat.
Okay, hang on. Like I'm grub-hubbing you. I'm grub-hubbing you a single bagel right now.
I ordered you a sub, but a foot long. The 6 inches were on sale. Yeah. So can you split that? It's a veggie sub. I didn't get sauce because, you know, it's extra.
Eventually, Winston Churchill wrote to FDR asking if he could do his job for him. And send U.S. ships. Fauna del Rey, that's right. Roosevelt. He wrote to Roosevelt asking if the U.S. president could do his job for him and send U.S. ships carrying wheat from Australia to India. But FDR replied saying that they needed their ships for the D-Day invasion at Normandy. He was like, my ships are kind of busy that day.
Like looks over at the calendar. It's just like a D on it. And he's like, ooh.
Sorry, we're storming the beach that day.
We're going to the beach. We're going to the beach.
We're going to make so many boomer men who watch too much History Channel like really mad at us for this episode.
Why? I don't know what D-Day is. I can say whatever I want about it.
We're going to the beach that day. Oh, it's when they went to the beach.
Yeah. Sounds great.
In France as well. Oh, I love the south of France. Churchill's defenders claimed that his refusal to send shipments of food to India was because he feared that British ships would be sunk or captured by the Japanese. Madhursi Mukherjee, in her expose on the famine, Churchill's Secret War, suggests that his contempt for the Indian people played a role in his decision-making. Quote, the War Cabinet shipping assignments made in August 1943, shortly after Amery had pleaded for famine relief, show Australian wheat flour traveling to Ceylon, the Middle East, and Southern Africa, everywhere in the Indian Ocean but to India. Those assignments show a will to punish.
I will never believe that it's possible to not be influenced by
the fact
that you're racist. like very specific. Like, I think you could be like a Christian and put that aside and do like science at the same time and have them like not really conflict. But I don't, like, specifically when it comes to like racism, I don't think you can put that aside. I don't think if you actually view people as less human than you are or as lesser than you are, that you can ever create policy that affects them directly without that impacting you. And if anyone says that that's like possible, I don't think they've unpacked some of the things that maybe they need to work on with themselves.
Yeah. I mean, he said that they were biologically starving anyway.
Yeah. They're assigned starving at birth.
So a lot of people start dying. The very first deaths started in rural areas in the countryside, probably around November of 1942. But as we get into early 1943, they start skyrocketing. As I kind of mentioned in the story from the beginning of the episode, people started trying to make their way from the countryside into Calcutta, the capital city, hoping that there would be food or work there. But this just put more of a strain on the city's resources. Eventually, food would become so scarce
Rather than even asking for rice, desperate people would beg for the starchy rice water left over from cooking rice. It got so desperate that people started abandoning their families. Men who were healthy enough at the start of the famine to join the armed forces or to work as day laborers outside of Bengal did so. Some women ran off with other men who could feed them or became sex workers, either of their own accord or because they were sold into sex work by relations. Other women whose husbands couldn't feed them would return to their fathers' homes, and if their fathers couldn't feed them, they would kill themselves. Parents even sold their children, sometimes only for a kilogram of rice. Exploitation of women and children ran rampant. The women who migrated to Calcutta on their own could only access food or cash through begging or sex work. Lots of girls were kidnapped and then pimped out to soldiers stationed in Calcutta or sold as domestic servants, where they would grow up as little better than slaves. Wealthier people took advantage of the crisis to buy up other people's land, again, sometimes just for rice. And when starvation or diseases like malaria started taking out whole families, the wealthy landowners would scoop up the land of the deceased. Allied forces stationed in Bengal and wealthier Indians like Amartya Sen and Partha Meter were basically completely insulated from the famine. In 3 Million, Partha states that his family never lacked for rice. The last surviving witnesses to the famine, almost all people who were wealthy enough to be insulated from it, describe how the specter of the famine still haunts them. Living people looked like skeletons, and the streets began to fill with the corpses of famine victims being fed on by vultures. The political artist Chittaprasad Bhattacharya drew this sketch of a famine victim in his book, Hungry Bengal.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. The sketch is captioned, "His name was Krishnamohan Naik." Which, like, it is really, like, so many of these people just died, like, unknown and unremembered. Yeah. Copies of Hungry Bengal were burned by British police.
Fuck off.
I think there's only one that still exists. Maybe two, maybe a couple. Basically ones that were like literally just in his possession that are still the official property of his family. British police, like, I think they gathered like 5,000 copies and burned them in the streets. Eventually, the streets of Calcutta were overrun with the dead and dying, so the colonial government instituted the Bengal Vagrancy Act of 1943 to criminalize the starving unhoused. And I'm not going to send this to you now, but at some point, like, I will probably drop in a photo. There are photos of the Bengal famine that, like, literally, like, alleyways stacked probably waist high with bodies. Bodies that are not, like, intentionally stacked by, like, disposal units, like, bodies that fell that way. And then there's, like, the roofs of all of the houses are just covered in vultures. And some of the survivors who remember it, not survivors of the famine, but witnesses to the famine, because again, like, the people who actually survived starving still didn't live to be in their 90s. But the people who still remember it today were children at the time who were wealthy enough to get out of it unscathed. And they, like, in 3 Million, you hear some of them describe how disgusting it was. Like, you left the house and there would just be vultures feeding on bodies everywhere you went. They were begging for the water left over from making rice.
Like, this would be terrible if somehow this had occurred, and it had to have occurred, like, some virus, some bacteria, whatever, wiped out all of the crops or something. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it would still be fucking horrendous, but the fact that this was caused by a few people who are either choosing to sign or not sign a couple documents.
Willful administrative incompetence. Like, it's because ultimately it's because this government doesn't see these people as people. Mm-hmm. So actually, before we move on, should we take another break?
Yeah.
Censorship was a matter of course during wartime. There were wartime censors assigned to read through the letters sent to and from servicemen and their families in order to redact any classified information that might fall into enemy hands. And there was also censorship for the purpose of propaganda.
Yeah.
The British government feared that news of the famine in news of any famine in British colonies would be bad for soldiers' morale, and that it would be used by the Axis powers as propaganda against Great Britain.
Propaganda.
So,
telling the truth.
So colonial censors were charged with deleting information about the famine in letters from family members of servicemen fighting the war. And newspapers, yeah. So, like, people back home in Bengal, because again, there were Indian soldiers who were fighting on the front in Europe.
Yeah,
and so people back
home
would
write and
be like,
"They didn't want them to hear about that."
Yeah, like, too bad. Mom's gonna say, like, "Yeah, grandma just starved to death," and that's gonna get redacted because they don't want Indian soldiers fighting and dying for them to know.
Yeah,
and the newspapers were forbidden from using the word famine in their publications.
My fucking God.
For the first few months of the famine, the Statesman, one of the largest English language newspapers in India at the time, towed the party line, publishing articles blaming local traders for hoarding and praising the colonial administration. But by the summer of 1943, something changed. Ian Stevens, the editor of the Statesman, publishes a scathing editorial about the British government's mismanagement of the food crisis in Bengal. But that doesn't get very much traction, probably because euphemisms like food crisis and food question didn't really communicate like the severity of
it. Doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, but especially in wartime when like everybody is dealing with like rationing, like they're like, we all have food crises right now. But it's like, no, it's different what's going on here. So frustrated at this, he knows that he's going to have to adopt a different tactic to draw attention, like the attention of the general public and the powers that be, to the famine. Publishing the word famine was prohibited under the censors' emergency rules. However, the rules didn't say anything about photographs. So Ian Stevens hires a couple of photographers to go out into the streets of Calcutta and take photos of famine victims. And it only takes them a couple of hours before they return to him with some extremely graphic photos. Some of them were so gruesome that Stevens considered them utterly unpublishable. But on Sunday, August 22nd, 1943, he publishes this one.
Fuck.
Yeah. So it's a picture of a woman and two children. She's crouching above the two children. It's unclear if the two children are alive. They're laying on the ground. And my favorite part of this story is that he published this photo adjacent to the Sunday crossword. So every single person skipping to the crossword in the Sunday paper had to look at the face of the famine playing their silly little game.
I love him.
Yeah. The Statesman was not only one of the largest English language papers in India, but it was published internationally. So the international community, including the British public, were seeing images of the famine for the very first time. issues of the paper with the famine photos flew off the stands, and secondhand copies were selling for twice their retail price. Like, this was people were paying attention. The chief press advisor in Delhi called the Statesman to berate them, but technically Stevens hadn't broken any censorship rules, so he couldn't do anything about it. And the following Sunday, Stevens published more photos alongside another scathing editorial piece called All India Disgrace, in which he told the world that scores of persons collapsing from undernourishment are daily picked up from the streets, recorded deaths from starvation cases in hospitals between August 16th and August 29th were 143. 155 dead bodies are known to have been removed from the public thoroughfares by authorities' new corpse disposal squad during the 10 days ending on August 24th. In his editorial, he placed the blame on the British colonial government, saying, "Thoughtful Britons must realize that so long as their nation, their parliament, and their secretary of state maintain some responsibility for India's welfare, the ultimate blame unavoidably rests upon themselves."
I was not prepared to hear that people actually cared. Well, I don't know that they cared, but that people paid attention. Like, I was so scared you were going to be like, "And nobody."
Well, I mean, like, this is a reason why, like, once again, I don't want to hear any bullshit about how, like, Churchill and the war cabinet and whatever were making impossible decisions or just like products of their time, because people were calling this out at the time. And again, at first it was, you know, officials like very quietly requesting aid, but eventually it's something that you can't avert your eyes from. Mm-hmm. And it, like, this man risked his career and possibly even his freedom to blow the whistle, because, like, I'm kind of surprised that he didn't get arrested.
Yeah, whether or not it's against the law doesn't actually control whether or not they arrest you.
Yeah.
Like, especially, like, any, if it's anywhere near wartime, they can just claim whatever the fuck they want. Like,
mm-hmm. So,
although I'm assuming in this situation that would have looked really bad for them.
Yeah. Yeah, which might have been why they didn't do it.
The only reason why they didn't is because, oh, the first person that speaks up about this immediately gets arrested. Silenced.
Yeah. So Indian papers immediately follow suit and start publishing photos and articles about the famine as well. Stevens continued publishing photos and articles about the famine, and for a period of like 8 weeks. And by the end of his campaign in September, he was identifying it as a man-made famine. He was using the F word. According to the historian Zarir Masani, Stevens also printed up 300 business cards with pictures of famine victims and took a train to Delhi and handed them out to every senior government official.
I don't think we mentioned it when we discussed the photo that was the first main photo, but the children that are in it are like emaciated, doesn't even begin to describe like what their arms look like.
They look like desiccated, like, corpses, and they might be. It's unclear, like, if they're alive.
It's just incredibly, like, I can see why people looking at that, even if those people themselves were going hungry, would realize that, like, this isn't a food crisis. Like, that photo shows, like, a different level of, like, destitution.
Right.
I just forget sometimes that we've got a few comments that were like, now that it's video, I can tell you're doing stuff over there, but we don't know what it is. So I just want to make sure that we describe
gorgeous
little Spotify girlies.
Eventually, due to the initial campaign by Ian Stevens and the Statesman, the BBC began reporting heavily redacted broadcasts about the Indian food question. And by the end of 1943, the British government began accelerating relief efforts. Historian Janam Mukherjee described the publication of the famine photos in The Statesman as a singular act of journalistic courage and conscientiousness without which many more lives would surely have been lost. And upon Ian Stephens' death in 1984, Amartya Sen wrote, "In the subcontinent in which Ian Stephens spent a substantial part of his life, he is remembered not only as a great editor with amiable, if somewhat eccentric, manners, but also as someone whose hard-fought campaign possibly saved the lives of hundreds of thousands of people." And I do just want to like underline the fact that this dude was a Cambridge-educated, upper-middle-class white dude who was completely insulated from the famine himself. But he saw it around him because he was living in Calcutta, and he did the right thing. And I had to talk about mm-hmm. him today to hold him up as a foil to Winston Churchill, who knew what was happening and continually kept declining to do anything about it. And he was the most powerful person in the empire. More powerful than the literal king.
Like, I'm glad you told his story for that purpose, but also just like, what a fucking badass. Inspiring, amazing. So glad I know of him now. But let's just get his name one more time for those of us who have forgotten. Not me.
Ian Stephens.
Ian Stephens, right.
Yes.
Exactly. Yes. That's what I was going to say because I knew his name.
In September of 1943, Lord Archibald Wavell, such a British name.
I want to shove him in a locker. I want to dip him in upside down into a garbage can. I want to shake him until all his lunch monies come out of his pockets and clatter on the floor.
Sometimes I'm writing down these names and I know that they're going to laugh. So I know to like write in a pause for laughter, but sometimes I forget until I'm saying their names and I realize how silly they sound. Archibald Wavell.
Like, this sounds fake. This sounds like
Lord Archibald Wavell.
Sounds like me writing a period piece.
Lord Archibald Wavell.
Oh, that's good. I love that.
That's what he sounds like.
Yeah, of course.
So he succeeds Victor Lumlithgow.
I also like that
Lumlithgow.
He only says his name also like a Pokemon.
Nothing else. He never says anything else.
Archibald. I'm assuming he's bad.
He's cuter than some of the people in this story, but no one's cuter than Ian Stephens.
Okay.
He succeeds Victor Linlithgow as the Viceroy of India. Now, his first move as Viceroy was to visit the famine-stricken areas of Bengal. A year into the famine, that's where we're at this point, a full year into the famine, Wavell used his authority as Viceroy to authorize the full use of military famine resources, and he started a concerted effort of his own volition to start getting rice into the furthest reaches of Bengal. So that's why, like, it's too little too late, but he's definitely more of a hero than most of the people in the story. But this food aid is being brought in from other parts of India, not Britain or anywhere else in the empire. Yeah. So it's around this time that Leo Amery, the Secretary of State for India, reported that his request for food aid was met with a rant from Churchill about Indians breeding like rabbits. And declined.
Yeah.
Though by mid-1943 famine was being reported in the press, it was never officially declared by the government. The British Raj had a famine code in place since the 19th century. Essentially, it was like a series of tests designed to determine if there was a famine occurring and outlining the steps that the imperial government was required to take to mitigate a famine, like if those tests were to prove that there was a famine going on.
Yes.
Every single item on that checklist, every single test was met, but the British didn't want to declare a famine because of the war effort. They did not want to divert resources from the war effort, and the British government and war cabinet, headed by Winston Churchill, decided that millions of civilian Indian lives were an acceptable price to pay. The rice harvest at the end of 1943 was plentiful, promising an end to the famine, but Viceroy Wavell still worried that it wouldn't be enough to undo the damage, so he wrote to Churchill requesting grain. Churchill responded that he was very sorry, but we simply cannot find the shipping. Wavell sent a telegram to London on February 19, 1944, calling the Bengal famine one of the greatest disasters that had ever befallen any people under British rule, and damage to our reputation is incalculable. Wavell's request for 1 million tons of grain was granted. By the end of 1944, when it was too late. By the end of the famine, 1 in 20 Bengalis had died.
Jesus fucking Christ.
In episode 4 of 3 Million, Kavita Puri interviews Max Hastings, a conservative historian who has written a number of books about the Second World War and considers himself to be a great admirer of Winston Churchill. In the interview, Hastings states that all realistic historians and biographers of Churchill must recognize this very large blot on his record, referring to Churchill's callousness and antipathy toward the plight of Bengal. Hastings also remarked that Churchill's casually racist comments and jokes were considered shocking for his time. These comments include, "I hate people with slit eyes and pigtails. Whoa. I don't like the look of them or the smell of them." And that he did not really think that black people were as capable or as efficient as white people. Madhursi Mukherjee has even suggested that Churchill's inaction was in part retaliatory following the Quit India uprisings of 1942. Churchill was committed to the maintenance of the empire. In November of 1942, he stated, "I have not become the king's first minister in order to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire." He absolutely did preside over the liquidation of the British Empire, and India was awarded her independence in 1947. There has never been another famine in India. Churchill once said, "History will be kind to me, for I intend to write it." And he was right. In the eventual 6-volume history he'd write on the Second World War, Churchill never once mentions the Bengal famine or the role he played in the deaths of so many millions of innocent civilians.
What a piece of fucking shit.
Fuck him.
Like, even that, like, no penance, not even nobody could have known, or you know what I mean?
He knew before there was a famine.
Yeah.
He knew when the viceroy was writing to him and saying, "Hey, a famine's going to take place."
Yeah, but I mean, he could have at least lied.
We need food aid.
Like to just omit it altogether.
He didn't care. Yeah.
As opposed to reframing it.
It was a non-issue to him.
Yeah.
It was a non-issue. 3 million people disappeared.
That's a city. Like, that's...
Yeah, that's almost a Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So that's the story of Winston Churchill and the Bengal famine.
I'm so glad there's going to be more on him.
Yeah, we'll wait a while.
Yeah, please. One a year.
I need to start spacing out these bad ones.
Yeah, I know. Your next one needs to be about, like, some gay penguin who, like, pushed someone off an ice float or something cute.
All right. Iconic. You can find Respect the Dead on all platforms at _respectthedead. You can find me on Instagram at Amanda Hootman, I think, and on and on Twitter at Punished Hoots. You can find my YouTube channel at Hoots YouTube. Kaylin?
You can find me on literally everything as at Kaylin Conrad, C-A-E-L-A-N.
And you can find our editor, Rob, at Mr. Posts Good. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Rob.
All right. See you all in the next one. I hope the next one's funnier.
Yeah, it will be.